Well, hello, my dear friends, and thank you for being part of our show today. Greg Kokel here from Los Angeles in my cabin, suffering from cabin fever. Theoretically so, my cabin. Actually, not my cabin, Wisconsin. And I look forward to heading out there in about 4 weeks, 3.5 weeks, whatever. In the meantime, I'm still stuck here in Southern California. It's getting hotter and hotter, but outside, doing some yard work outside. But most people aren't supposed to go outside right now because of the restraints that we're facing. So it's a crazy period of time, but I hope that the things that not just I bring to you on the show here, but what Stand to Reason is able to bring to you through all the things that we're doing right now will help you during this time. We're here for you is basically our motto right now. It's always our point of view, but especially now when we know that everybody's feeling certain needs much more aggressively than they ever have felt. Now, in my case, and I don't know, mostly it's Stand to Reason, but we haven't missed a beat, to be honest with you. We're inconvenienced, but to be sure, but we are not handicapped. And we are doing interviews and Facebook Lives, and each of us is doing something particular. Our blog's still running full force. Amy's a bit under the weather, but I think she's still posting things. And incidentally, I hope this doesn't embarrass her, but I just want to ask for prayer for Amy because she's been struggling for many weeks now with just sickness, and we just want her to get back on her feet and feeling better. So we'd appreciate that prayer. We don't want to go into a lot of detail, but it's not lethal, but it probably feels that way to her much of the time. So it really saps her of her strength. So pray for Amy. The rest of us are doing really well, though, and Amy's still, you know, working as she's able. And in fact, she's taking phone calls right now. And if you'd like to call, you're welcome to do so. 855-243-9975 is my number. And, of course, if you're listening on time delay somewhere else at some other time, that's the number to call between 4 and 6 p.m. on Tuesday evenings, Los Angeles time. That's West Coast. And Amy will pick up and chat with you a moment and then put you in the queue as she's doing it some right now. So be glad to chat with you about anything that's on your mind in the area of ethics, values, and religion. You know, I was thinking about this time, and what we do a lot is our team gets together for our staff meetings, usually on Tuesdays, and we have it looks like Hollywood Squares because we're Zooming and we've got 16, 17, 18 people all squared out there, jumping into the conversation, carrying on. But we're brainstorming the best ways we can help you right now at this time. And Meg asked a question, not sure exactly how she worded it, but it had to do with what do we think is the most important thing that we can bring to our people, that's you, during this time of frustration and concern and in some cases fear and in other cases tragedy in individual lives. What is it that we can give you? And almost immediately, the idea came to my mind, and in fact, I tweeted on it. Incidentally, if you want to find my Twitter, is that how you say it? Or my tweets, if you want to go to my Twitter page, it's just Greg Kokel, all lowercase, run together. That's me. That's how you can find me. Or is it at Greg Kokel? I don't know how this works. Somebody else put it together for me. But, you know, I have a little different philosophy of tweeting. I don't tweet a lot of news with links that you can go and see other things. Twitter for a lot of people is passing news on. And then you pass that on to other people if you think that piece of news is valuable. I just don't do that because I don't traffic too much in the news. What I try to do is put out a short aphorism, a snippet of thought that I think might be helpful to you. And if you think it's helpful, you'll pass it on to someone else. So that's basically the idea. But in this particular case, I was responding to the question that was raised during our staff meeting. And it occurred to me that in this time where we are experiencing a deep awareness of our vulnerability, and that's what we're doing. We are always vulnerable. We are contingent beings, okay? And just to give you a screwy little illustration of this, I stopped my car in a street. I was kind of pulling over a little bit to stop and do something with my phone because I didn't want to do it while I was driving. And when I pulled over and there weren't any other cars around, I went a little too far and I banged my tire directly into the curb. I mean, it was just a little bump, but it shook my whole vehicle and it shook me too. And it was just a little bump on my tire. And I think the point that I'm making is lots of times we're going through life and we're not getting bumped at all, and we don't realize how vulnerable we are to just a little bitty bump can really shake us up. I don't know what it would feel like to get in a real car accident. But for many of us, when times are good, we are not aware of the vulnerability that we actually share at every moment. Our lives are contingent. We are dependent. We are vulnerable. And when things like the current crisis hit us, for many of us, this is the way we feel, really vulnerable. We're aware of our vulnerability. I was mentioning a few moments ago that for me and our staff, we're still working away. We're working in a different way. And so in some ways, our lives haven't changed too much, except for we're working at home. But we're still working, and we have plenty of things to do. So we're not sitting, twiddling our thumbs, wondering what's next, having gone through all our DVDs, watched every TV show that we want to watch, sleeping until noon, or whatever people do when they're just bored to death. Because we're not bored. We're working. But so there's a certain sense which I haven't felt the impact of vulnerability because it hasn't hurt me too much except for just inconvenience me. I'm actually spending more time with my family, which theoretically is a good thing. It does have its liabilities, as we all know. And that goes both directions. Dad's home again today? Oh, my goodness. But I know many other people are in a difficult spot, and that is a hardship right now, this spot that they're in. And so what I thought of as far as what Stand to Reason provides for our people when they are experiencing their vulnerability is a reminder first that there's only one place of true safety in dangerous times, which means in all times, because all times are dangerous. That's the vulnerability we all have, though we're not always feeling it in the moment. Just run your car to the curb, though, and you'll feel it right quick. Whoa! That's my point there. There's only one true place of safety in dangerous times, and that is in the hands of our loving Father. But there's a problem with that, and the problem with that is, are we in the hands of a loving Father? What gives us confidence that that's the case, especially when things are rough? And our emotions betray us. The feeling of the closeness of God isn't there. The feeling of the Spirit encouraging us, the joy of the Lord is our strength. The joy is not there, so the strength isn't there. And this happens to everybody. Pardon me. All Christians experience that kind of thing at different times. And many of you might be experiencing it. So what do we do at Stand to Reason? We don't just tell you the safest place in dangerous times is in the hands of a loving Father. We give you good reasons to have confidence that God is there and that He's in control, no matter what you may feel or what you may be facing. And I tell you this offer it to you in a very personal sense, because this is precisely the way my own life operates. I know, as a matter of fact, the safest place in any times, which are always dangerous in a certain sense, are in the hands of our loving Father. And even when I don't feel his arms around me, his hands under me, when I feel vulnerable and unprotected, I know I am safe in the ways that really matter. Because I have good reasons to have confidence that God is there, no matter what I feel. And no matter what I face, and so I pass that information on to you. Now, with that in mind, given that I think one of the most important things that we can offer you at Stand to Reason is to provide for you a sense of safety by providing for you when you're in a tight spot, like now, the confidence that you're not alone. And it's not just us that are rooting for you and trying to help. I mean, think about it. When you are in a tight spot, just generally speaking, you know the help's on the way. You can hang on. And the knowledge that God is there is an affirmation that help is on the way in your tough times. And that helps us to persevere. And the fact is that it is not just on the way, but there is help right here now, a present help for us in time of trouble. God sustains us. You know, I have this habit now I've developed maybe the last 6 months. It's before I get into bed at night, I take a knee and I say, thank you, God, for getting me through the day. You know, it does not matter if I have an emotional sense that I have been carried along by the grace or goodness or power of God. I mean, sometimes you feel that, right? You think, oh, things are hard, but I have the sense God is there with me. He's walking with me. He's holding my hand. And boy, lots of times to have that conscious existential awareness of God's presence is really important. But it's not always the case. But I know God is there. I know he's helped me to get through hard things during the day. I know it's because of him that even though I work hard at doing a broadcast or a talk or an interview now online, Zoom or what's the other one? Skype or something like that. That when I work doing my job, God is working doing his job. And that the fruit that comes out of that is because of what he's doing. And so I say thank you. It's a thank you based on my knowledge, not based on my feeling. It's a reminder of God's presence in my life through everything throughout the day and an appropriate display of gratitude for the God who took care of me. Okay, now all of that is kind of a predicate to what I wanted to talk about here at the beginning of the show. I'm looking at the clock, and I've been jabbering for almost one full segment. But I thought it might be helpful to identify some of the reasons or some of the ways or some of the arguments that make a difference for me when I am tempted to wonder whether God is there in the midst of my troubles, okay? And by the way, everybody doubts. This isn't a Christian problem. It's a human problem. We all are inclined to question our deepest convictions about the world, especially when things don't go smoothly. So the real question is, how do we handle them? Do we have recourse to something that will help answer our questions in a satisfying way? Not just an intellectually satisfying way, but an emotionally satisfying way as well. And this is what I find in Christianity. So when I have my doubts, I return to some things like what I'm going to talk about here. Now, I have two different arguments I was going to offer, but I'm just going to offer one for the sake of time here. Then we'll take a break and get on to your calls. I want to introduce the first line of thinking, the first rationale, first argument, if you will, which is my favorite, actually. I want to introduce it with a question. And the question is, what is the most frequently raised objection against theism of any sort, including Christian theism? What is it? By the way, this question, being the first one that launches this line of thinking, is really, really important, because I know what you're going to say, probably, if you thought about it for a moment, and not just you, but anyone who considers these things. The most frequent objection that's raised against the existence of God is the problem of evil. And there's a reason for that. There's a reason why people go there almost immediately when considering this issue. Because there's one thing that every person knows, no matter where he lived or lives, or when he lived or lives. Everyone knows the world's broken, man. There is something wrong. Things are not the way they're supposed to be. That's the complaint about the problem of evil. And by the way, when they say this, they do not simply mean that things happen that they don't like. That would be the relativism issue. They're not just saying, oh man, I don't like that. Like you're looking at a plate of food and you're saying, hey, Brussels sprouts, no way. Liver, ugh. No, when they complain about the problem of evil, they are not saying that there are some things in the world they don't like. They are saying some things in the world that aren't right. They shouldn't be that way. They're not the way they're supposed to be, okay? There really is evil. That's why they say, why is there so much evil in the world? Because they're subtly, without thinking about it really, making the claim or the point that the evil is out there. It's real. It's not inside. It's not subjective. It's not tied to the subject, whether the subject is an individual who evolved a certain feeling about morality, or whether the subject is a group of people who made a contract with each other to live a certain way, social contract. It's still the subject in that sense. It tells us something about what people believe, not anything about the nature of evil itself. But the complaint has to do with the nature of the way the world is. Out there, objectively, the complaint is based on objective evil. And as you'll see in a moment, I love this complaint. I don't like the evil, but this complaint is our friend, because everyone has access to the world that's broken. They know it. The awareness is universal. It's an obvious and undeniable feature of reality. And therefore, I think we can easily use it as an ally to make our case for God. Because contrary to popular belief, the problem of evil is not a good argument against God. It's actually one of the best arguments for God. In fact, the problem with the problem of evil is that if God does not exist, there can be no real objective evil out there in the world to object to. Okay? So some of you might be wondering why. And it's because the complaint itself requires transcendent universal laws that govern the world. And here I just simply mean objective morality. Morality out there. In order for evil to exist as a violation of those laws. Okay? When people say that there's evil in the world, they're saying things ain't right. They're wrong. Well, they can only be wrong if there's a way that is right. Moral obligations that are not fulfilled or are violated by people who do the wrong. So every time you say there's evil, it's a way of saying there is a good that's obliged that is not accomplished. And it's the good that's obliged that I'm getting at. There are rules in the universe. Or maybe better put, there are laws, transcendent moral laws. When I say transcendent, I mean they are above human opinion. They are universals. Even when people disagree they're still there because they are objective features of reality, even though they're not physical. They're still real in the deepest sense. And if there are transcendent moral laws, and there must be for there to be a problem of real evil, then there must be a transcendent moral lawmaker, God. So saying the world is supposed to be a certain way kind of requires a sposer, right? Someone who intended the world to be much better than it actually is. So, on this line of thinking, if there is no God, then there is no transcendent moral lawmaker. And if there is no lawmaker, then there are no universal moral laws that we're obliged to obey. And if there are no moral laws, then there are no broken laws. That's pretty straightforward. That's relativism, by the way, no laws. And if no broken laws, then no problem of evil. So simply put, if there is no God, there can be no evil, or good for that matter. Both evil and good are tied to the same set of laws. It's just all lost in a twilight of moral nothingness. No evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference, as Richard Dawkins put it. Okay, and he's right. In his world, on his worldview, he's right. If there is no God, he's an atheist, then that's it. Nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. And some people are going to get lucky and some people are going to get unlucky, and that's just the way it is. That's what he says. However, by the way, in that circumstance, if there's no good or no evil, then there is no evil, Mr. Dawkins. So how could you affirm that in this world, materialistic world, with no God, that there is no good and evil? How could you then complain about the problem of evil? That question doesn't fit in your worldview. But the reverse is also true then, if you think about it. Since there is a problem of evil, we all know this, there must be broken laws, so there must be laws. So there must be a law maker, so there must be God, because he's the only individual that fulfills, that is adequate to ground the kind of transcendent moral law that we're talking about, law with obligations. You know, if we have moral obligations, if we ought to be kind, that essentially can be put in the form of a command. Actually, I just did that. We ought to be kind, or be kind would be, I guess, more direct command. But obligations are held between persons. Commands are given by persons. And we are obliged to obey the command the person gives us, if we are obliged to obey at all. That means you can't get a person out of the equation at the very top of the enterprise. Now, if you want the philosophic mumbo-jumbo, I'll give it to you. What I've offered to you is classically called the moral argument for the existence of God, okay? And I can state it as a syllogism. It looks kind of like this. If there is no God, then there is no objective morality. That's the first premise, all right? In other words, if there's no lawmaker, there are no laws. Secondly, but there is objective morality. We know this because of the problem of evil. Therefore, there is a God. Now, that's a very normal, ordinary syllogism. I think it's modus tollens, if you want the fancy schmancy. It's a valid syllogism, and it turns out the premises are true. There is objective morality, problem of evil, but there can't be an objective morality if there is no objective moral lawmaker. Therefore, there is such a one, and that's the one that we call God. So in a certain sense, I've reduced this, the fairly common sense notions here, and walked you through this and reduced it to a fairly tight syllogistic form. May even sound academic, but you know what? That's at the heart, for me, of my confidence that during hard times, during difficult times, during confusion, during bad feelings about things, during questions of why are things happening this way, That is the line of thinking that helps me to be confident in knowing that there is a God and that He is available to me to help me. As Francis Schaeffer put it so aptly, He is there. He also added, and He is not silent. That's another that's another part of the equation. Maybe we'll talk about at another time. All right, I'm Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason, back in a moment.
Did you know Stand to Reason has a YouTube channel? We release a new video each Monday on the topics you care about. Through short, engaging videos, our speakers train you on tactics, offer apologetics tips, answer common theology questions, and address big issues in the world today. Join tens of thousands of other subscribers so you can stay up to date when we release a new video. Just go to youtube.com and search STR Videos, all one word, and hit the subscribe button. That's STR Videos. Take advantage of this free resource to help you stay informed, encouraged, and equipped as you share your worldview with others.
What should you say to your non-Christian friend who rejects Christianity? Hi, I'm Alan Schliemann, and I want to tell you what steps I take before I respond to non-Christian friends and family. Find out my response in this month's episode of my podcast, Thinking Out Loud with Alan Schliemann. Look for it on iTunes, your favorite podcast app, or at the top of the homepage at str.org.
Couple of quick thoughts here. Greg Kokel, by the way. A couple of quick thoughts before we move to our callers. We have, let's see, what do I got in my mind? Oh, we've got a whole fun thing that we're launching coming up on Wednesday, April 29th. That would be tomorrow for my broadcast. I guess this podcast goes out tomorrow, so it might be today for you then, or couple days ago if you're listening late. But in any event, it's a new video series that we call Red Pen Logic with Mr. B, Mr. Barnett, who was formerly a teacher and still has the instinct to get out his red pen and start slashing about when error abounds with important issues. And what he has been doing is going to sites where tweets are posted that amount to rationales or arguments or statements against Christians or Christianity or against Jesus or against God. And when he sees that happening, that are in cases that are foolishly argued and basic mistakes are in evidence, well, that old teacher spirit just takes a hold of him and he grabs his red pen and he goes to it. And so we call this Red Pen Logic, where Tim picks apart bad ideas in a really kind of a fun and engaging way. It's not a whole, it's not a long thing. I think they're just three or four, five on the outside minute pieces. You'll get the visual where he puts the red pen to the statements, and then he explains why he's doing what he's doing. It'll be posted online. Let me see where we have this. Look for it on the new Red Pen Logic YouTube channel or STR's website and social media channel. So first one launches tomorrow, and I've seen it, and I think it's a lot of fun. And I think you'll enjoy it and be educated at the same time. I mentioned this the last couple of weeks, but just so you know, we are looking for a new location for our student conferences. Now, we hold those all around the country. They used to be called Rethink. We have a new name for them. Now they are called Reality Apologetics. And so if you want the skinny on any conference in any part of the country, as time goes on, realityapologetics.com is the website. But we have been meeting for a long time in Montgomery, Alabama. That's our southern regional event, and we're looking for a new home. So you might have a church in the Montgomery area. You might have – I'm sorry, we've been meeting in Birmingham, my bad. And but we're looking for a new home, and it could be in Birmingham. It could be in Montgomery further south. It could be in Atlanta, a little further east in Georgia. It could be north in Nashville or in Knoxville. And we're looking for a church that can hold pretty, at least initially, close to about 2,000 people, because that's, we were pushing those numbers when, in our last, actually our very first Birmingham event was 1,600 kids. So it's fluctuated a little bit. But there's a great potential there to push past 2,000, like we have in other events in Orange County and up in Minnesota and Minneapolis, St. Paul area. So we're looking for somebody who's got a church that can hold a good number of people and who understands what we're doing and is willing to work hard to partner with us. We've got the turnkey operation. We know how to make this happen, but the boots on the ground make the biggest difference. And we want to make sure that there's top-down buy-in on this. That means the head pastor and the other pastors see what this could mean to their local community, their own church, and also churches around them in their community, and building up the body of Christ and passing the baton to the next generation. If you have a church in mind for that, contact Dawn Yell. That would be DawnIelle. Her email is dawnyell@str.org. Okay. One other thing I wanted to mention to you is that, Giving Tuesday is coming up. And over the last few months, the reaction to COVID-19 has upended lots of people's lives, including ours. Now, we know we've got Christ and we never lose hope, but we can really be inconvenienced. And there's no promise that won't happen. And there are other areas that we might struggle, but the fact is we've never been more convinced of our need to continue the important work that God gave us more than 27 years ago. And let's see, I'm just a couple days from May 1st here on my watch. What is that, 27, 28 years? How many? I had to do the math. 2009. I don't know. We've been around 2003. 3 from 11 is 7. Is that right? No, it's 8. 28 years. Our anniversary is coming up. We started in 1993, and you can do the math yourself because I don't have a calculator right here, and I'm never good at this kind of thing, especially when you cross over like a millennium. That makes it harder. Our anniversary is coming up. But all that time, we have been convinced of a task that's laid before us that we are working hard to fulfill. And we've heard from many of our STR friends how our resources and our messages have continued to encourage them as so many of us are sheltered in place. And you need to know that we continue to be here for you. I mean, we just want to keep saying that. And we are planning even more great resources to debut this fall. Many of you know we have a new website that just launched. It's great. And we're really thankful for all those who have been able to partner with us in supporting Stand to Reason through these challenging times. But the reality is that we are being challenged financially too, okay? And this is the case for all kinds of nonprofits across the country, which is why Giving Tuesday is so important. And what I see here is hashtag Giving Tuesday Now was created in response to the need that's caused by the COVID-19 difficulties. So I want to encourage you to take part in this global day of giving. It's Tuesday, May 5th, right? Is that 2 weeks or is that 1 week? That's 1 week from today? Yeah. And help us out with a tax-deductible gift of any amount, all right? And just to encourage you in generous giving, it turns out the new CARES Act allows all taxpayers to take a charitable deduction of up to $300, even if you don't itemize. So that makes it easier for you, okay? That's why I want to ask, for our sake, for the kingdom's sake, and also because it could help you with the government, would you consider making a tax-deductible contribution to us? We understand that our donors are really facing economic uncertainty here in these challenging times. So every gift, no matter what the amount, will make a difference. If you want to go to our website, I actually don't know. I should look it up. But I think that's where you can give that gift between now and Tuesday next week. And also as a celebration of our, I think it's 28-year anniversary. Derek is nodding his head like, oh, my goodness, Alzheimer's disease is setting in. Yeah, that's right. It set in a long time ago, Derek. Earlier for me than most, I'm afraid. All right, with that done, let's go to our callers here. And we have Independence, Ohio, and Jeremy. Welcome to the show, Jeremy.
Hi.
Hey there.
So I was recently reading one of the articles on STR, and it was Tim Barnett was talking about faith.
Uh-huh.
And it's I've been debating a lot of atheists, you know, comment section on YouTube and various other social media. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the accusations, is that it's faith, you know, like faith is some, you know, it's for a bunch of dumb knuckle draggers that shouldn't even, you know, function. But they, you know, they never even bothered to look up the definition of faith. It's belief. Mm-hmm. It's the assent of the mind to the truth of what's declared by another. That's the definition. And so every time they, you know, read a study by a scientist and they accept it at face value, that's faith. So,
okay.
You know, that's my whole purpose was to, you know, there's all kinds of reasons to believe in Christianity.
Sure.
And, you know, I don't know. I want to see everybody saved, honestly.
Yeah, and the atheists make it harder because they are working very, very hard to distort the notion of faith. And unfortunately, there are some Christians that abet it because they are confused about this definition that you just offered. When we look in the New Testament and we see that people are enjoined to have faith— that means they're enjoined to put their trust in Jesus, and there are an abundance of reasons that are given as evidence for people to make that step of trust, not the leap of faith. And so if someone like an atheist is going to criticize our view, well, it's their job to criticize our view and not their distortion of our view. And our view is not based on what some confused Christian says, but what the text itself characterizes faith to be. So you and I are on the same page here, but you, apparently you have some concern with Mr. Barnett in the way he's characterized it. Is that right? I'm looking at your question here.
Yeah, it's it just seemed to me like I agreed with most of what he said, but it there's a distinction between, like, you know, faith is trust. It's trusting in what God told us in his word, you know.
Uh-huh.
And of course we have evidence to back it up, but there's not a distinction between belief and trust. It's the same thing. It's believing what you've heard. It's believing the eyewitness accounts.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's just, I know a lot of the, you know, the atheists offer, it's, there are a lot of logical fallacies, like Dr. Dawkins talking about, you know, like I'd watched it earlier, who created God.
Right, right. That's, of course, a category error. But let me just say something about this faith issue and belief. Just so you know, the scripture actually uses the word belief in different ways. It says in John chapter 2 that some people, there were many that believed in him. This is right at the very beginning of his ministry. There are many believed, but Jesus was not entrusting himself to any of them because he knew what was in the heart of man. And as you move through the Gospel of John, I think even John 8, there's a big argument that Jesus has with Jewish leadership, who it says they, many of them, believed in him. And so it does make a distinction. I think it's fair for us to keep this in mind. And in the story of reality, I try to parse this out a little more carefully, there is one kind of belief and then there is another kind of belief. And the belief that you and I are talking about, that saving, that salvific, that's the real important thing, is an active trust in what you have good reason to believe is true. Okay. Now, there are some people – good. There are some people, and you see in the scripture, who believed that – and this is my terminology here, but it's a way of distinguishing between these two categories. They believed that, but they didn't believe in. The Pharisees believed that Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead. Okay, now this was a magnificent evidence that he was who he had claimed to be just before he did that miracle, that he was the resurrection and the life. Okay, then he raises a dead man. Okay, so this is an attesting miracle proving his messianic office. Okay, there were lots of Pharisees that believed that he did that. In fact, it bothered them because here was Lazarus walking around as living proof of Jesus' messianic office. And so because they believed that he raised Lazarus from the dead, but they didn't believe in Jesus and trust in Jesus as a result, they sought to have Lazarus killed. And that's in John, I think it's chapter 12, you know. They sought to have Jesus killed, but they also sought to have Lazarus killed. So this is like an unbelievable unbelief. On the one hand, they believed after a certain fashion, but in another way, the way that mattered the most, they did not believe, that is, put their trust in. And last illustration, and then I'll let you weigh in on this, and that is when I used to go on trips before the shutdown, you know, I had every confidence that the airplane that I was scheduled to board would fly me to a different to another destination. And so I believed it, but I did not exercise faith, the kind that we're talking about, in that belief until I got on the airplane. And once I got on the airplane, then they got me. You know, I'm all in, so to speak.
That would be the distinction I would make. I agree entirely with that.
Right. Now, did Tim not make that distinction, or do you feel as something he wrote, he was kind of playing fast and loose with it?
I think that he didn't go far enough on it. Like, that would have been a better way to clarify that, all in. Like, I don't, like, not, you're not, you don't have any other recourse. That's like, you all,
right,
you know, all in, right. Like even in poker.
Right. That's a terrible analogy, exactly. Yeah, that's it, man. You're at the mercy of the cards at that point. But I mean, I'm absolutely convinced that Tim shares my view on this and yours as well. Sometimes it's hard in any given situation when any of us is communicating about something that we may not, as you put it, gone far. We may not have gone far enough. We may not have included enough details to absolutely secure the point, or maybe we misspeak sometimes. I know some people have objected to me when I make reference to Frank Turek's book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. Well, there he's not using
book.
The – yeah, it's a great book, but notice he's using the word faith there in a tongue-in-cheek kind of way. I don't have the kind of blind faith that atheists talk about in order to be an atheist.
Right.
If you want me to be an atheist, I'm going to have to exercise blind faith, and I don't have that kind of faith because I know too much. And that's what he explains in his book. So, but some people have felt that the title itself, trades a little bit on the false, too much on the false definition of faith, and maybe gives away too much ground. And so I can see how somebody would raise that objection. But like I said, I think Frank's tongue in cheek on that one. He knows the difference, certainly the thing that we're talking about. And sometimes maybe our speakers might say something like that could raise an eyebrow, but they certainly understand the distinctions that you and I are talking about.
Sure.
That's, so is there anything else?
One other comment I wanted to make too. I was watching a video earlier where you had given a talk up in Canada about, you know, the new atheism, and a lot of their arguments are totally fallacious. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to kind of recommend a resource. I don't have any affiliation with it, but it's a good book. It's Logically Fallacious. It's got a whole list of like 300 different both formal and informal fallacies.
Oh, really?
Like, okay. Yeah, like the argument from incredulity. Like just because that would be like a question, like how do you pronounce it? The column question?
The column question. Oh, column. Are you talking about an argument? It's called the Kalam, K-A-L-A-M. That is a cosmological argument that Bill Craig has.
I mean in the detective, like in your book, Tactics.
Oh, Columbo.
Columbo. Thank you.
Yeah,
sorry.
You must be
I
a young
totally
guy.
Wrong. Yeah.
Okay.
So, but just because you refuse to believe something doesn't disprove it.
Yeah.
And that's an argument from incredulity, and that's
right.
More common than any other fallacy that I've seen, honestly.
Huh. So the book you're recommending is called Logically Fallacious, is that right?
Mm-hmm. It's a website and a book.
Great.
I think his name's Bo. I think his last name's Barnett, too, or Bennett. It might be Bennett.
Okay. Well, thanks for the recommendation. And, I'll pass it on to Tim as well. But got to take a break here. So thank you so much for that call. Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason. We'll be back in just a moment with more calls.
Some people treat Christianity like it's a build-your-own Sunday shop. They include the bits they like and exclude the bits they don't. The problem is, truth is not ice cream. You can't build your own biblical reality like you build your own ice cream sundae. You can't pick and choose the parts you prefer. Truth doesn't work like that. Truth is what matches up with reality. Sadly, there are some who are creating a version of Christianity that fits their own subjective desires rather than sound doctrine. At this year's STR Reality Conferences, you will get the tools to identify counterfeit versions of Christianity so you can guard against them. We want to show you that biblical reality isn't something we shape, rather, it's something that shapes us. So join us at one of this year's reality conferences and let's discover why truth is not ice cream.
You know, if you've gained anything from listening to Stand to Reason, I'd really be thrilled to hear it from you. I love to take your questions, of course, but I also want your feedback. So here's what you can do. Head over to iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave us a rating and a review. That kind of thing really helps us to get the word out so more ambassadors for Christ can find the show and become equipped to stand confidently. And you never know, I might just give you a shout out on the air to show you my appreciation for your positive review. I value you as a faithful listener. I look forward to reading what you think about the show. Thanks. All righty, friends. By the way, since we have changed the name of Rethink to Reality Apologetics, all the new t-shirts in new events are going to be reality ones. We still have some Rethink t-shirts from the past. These are going to be retro items that will be in huge demand 15 or 20 or 30 years from now. And we are having a fire sale on those, but it ends on the 30th. So maybe you're listening to this too late. But if you go to str.org and go to our bookstore, is there a banner right there on our website, Derek, that, I mean, when you go to the main deal, it says something about it? Not sure. Okay. But you'll be able to find it. And instead of $25, they're $7.95, right? Bargain. Okay, we're a little slow on shipping right now for obvious reasons, but get your order in now. There's four different choices we have. They're going fast. We have limited supply. Sale ends on the 30th. All right, let's go to Ryan. And Ryan is somewhere, it doesn't say. But Ryan, welcome to the show.
Good evening. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Where are you, Ryan? Or is that a secret?
I'm in Charlotte.
Oh, Charlotte. Okay. Good to have you.
We're right below it. But so I have two things. One, I actually called you, gosh, I think maybe about a month and a half ago. I asked you for some resources on the Trinity.
Okay.
And I used quite a few of the ones you gave me. And
thank you.
I really appreciate it.
Good.
I did my presentation, and I feel it went pretty well. I think the only thing I did, I could have done better is reflecting about how the relational aspect really does, or the relational aspect of the Trinity is what makes the doctrine of our God much better and more appealing in the end than other religions. I didn't really
sure
that as well, but
yeah, well, certainly
like
it
pretty
well. It certainly adds more dimensions to it, but don't be too hard on yourself, you know. I mean, I've been doing this for a long, long time, and I still, you know, have gaffes and goof up and think, oh, I could have done this or I could have done that. So it's just a process. Look back with a gracious heart in your own presentation, and it's fine to ask, well, what could I do better? What could I make more clear? It's really a good idea to get feedback from other people and make notes of that so that next time around you can improve on it. But that's part of the process. Good for you.
The second, I actually had a question as well. I had a friend of mine, we've been talking for a while, and they've been going to a home church.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking to them about how I just like the idea of an organized church. And they said that if I was not in a, home church or in a style of what they don't have a preacher in their, church.
Uh-huh.
It's a very much more of a fellowship group, I almost would say. Like, I guess a very mature and knowledgeable sort of idea, almost like a Young Life quasi idea.
So it's more of is it more of a youth group or just kind of a fellowship group with no preacher in charge?
Fellowship.
And do you have different people that teach?
They do, but they're not like it's not like there's one person that's in charge.
Uh-huh.
It's much more relational and fellowship oriented of how that works. They are with Baha'i. It's very much how like what they would do with the religion or their teachings. They would have a person give a point. The other people are more than able to again to give opinions from different scriptural ideas.
Back on,
so they can use
right.
like other religions. But in this case, they're all evangelicals.
Right.
But they're all doing it more in a conversational Bible study methodology.
Okay.
All that to say, they were talking to me how that they said if they didn't really have this group, and they would be okay with falling under a position where they wouldn't really ever want to go to church. Because they don't feel like there's a need to be in a corporate body.
So wait, you're talking about an individual who's a friend of yours that has come to this group that you meet with on a regular basis, right?
No, I don't meet with the group. I go to an organized church in my here, like a little bit south of Charlotte.
Okay.
But they are part of a group like this.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay, so this individual identifies in some sense with Christianity, since these are all evangelical Christians, even though the form of their meeting is not like classical Western church style. Is that it?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure, yes.
Okay, gotcha so far.
So with that, though, I feel like in my personal opinion, and I could be wrong, and if I am, I would love to hear what you think about this.
Mm-hmm.
I really feel like there is a place for the organized church, and they really seem to dismiss it outright unless it's like something they want to really have a corporate experience on a holiday like Easter or something like that. So would you have any response to somebody who holds that idea of no corporate organization, of course, like a nun position, whatever you would call it?
Well, a person who is a nun, N-O-N-E, is someone who does not identify with any religious group. They are not claiming to be an agnostic. They are not claiming to be an atheist, but they are also not claiming to belong anywhere. And so they don't identify with any identifiable religious sect of any kind.
Okay.
They may be spiritual, but not religious. This might be the way they express it. They are aware of a spiritual dimension in life, one that they might have an existential awareness of, and they may do something regarding that. They may go on hikes and look at the sunset and behold the grandeur of the mountains, and this is a transcendent kind of experience for them. And so this is a way of identifying the transcendent spiritual element or feature of being human, yet at the same time not zeroing in on some particular way of defining that, it just keeping it rather general. C.S. Lewis talked about this. He said, yeah, you know, you can sit on the beach and behold the ocean and enjoy the ocean, but if you want to go anywhere, you got to get into a boat. You know, and I think that was a good illustration of this kind of thing. You can behold God or be aware of the transcendent in some general sense, but you're not going to be able to do anything other than have that kind of experience. You're not going to be able to do anything unless you have more particulars. If you have, you have to have a map and then a vehicle to get somewhere. And this is what Lewis referred to, was talking about when he mentioned theology. And so I think this is, for a lot of people, being a nun, N-O-N-E, is the place they're most comfortable with at the moment, because they may have had bad experiences in other churches. They might have, they don't like the, what they consider narrow-mindedness or the dogmatism or something like that, that some religious types express. They're uncomfortable, so they're just going to be spiritual, but not religious like that. They're not going to be doctrinaire and all that. Now, I think that's unfortunate. In fact, I had a period of my life where I was like that, where I didn't believe in organized religion. Now, I'll tell you, when I said that, I had not given 1 ounce of thought to it. This is what other people said. Oh, yes, that religion's organized. Oh, that couldn't be true. Really? Why does being organized have anything to do with being false? And it did occur to me, I mean, I've thought since then, that I ran into a bunch of other people who didn't believe in organized religion. I couldn't meet with them and talk with them about it because then I'd be too organized. Anyway, with a person that like that, and there's my music, so this will be my final comment. And thank you for that call, Scott. A person like that, I'm just going to ask him, why are they a nun, N-O-N-E, and why are they not attached to anything, and what is their concern about particulars of religious claims, and don't they think we could know anything like that or whatever? I'm going to draw them out and be a student of their belief. That's the first thing I do. All right, hope that helps, Scott, in Jacksonville, Florida. Oh, wait a minute, I just said goodbye. Scott, if you're in Jacksonville, please call back. I didn't mean to hang up on you. I was supposed to say goodbye to Ryan. Thank you, Ryan. Ouch, I hate it when I do that. Greg Kokel, give him heaven.